so real I could practically touch it. I felt loved and approved by God. Along with inner peace comes an outer peace that affects your daily life. In an earlier chapter, I mentioned a businessman named Wally and his dread of hotels. Wally can now check into a hotel at night, enjoy a meal at the coffee shop, go back to his room, shower, turn out the lights, and fall asleep. "I no longer fear hotel rooms in the slightest," he says. "Sensual things don't dominate my day as they once could. All those compelling desires that ruled me are gone, and yet my desire for my wife, Tina, still percolates rather nicely." You'll see the same positive impact on your desire for your wife with your victory in sexual purity. My captivating wife. Early in my marriage, I never fully gave myself emotionally to Brenda. I once thought that this was the result of some personality quirk of mine, but as it turns out, it was my sexual sin that held me back. Trust now comes more naturally since I've fully released myself to Brenda and forsaken my rights to a private sex life with my eyes and mind. Another reward is that Brenda no longer has fears about my having affairs with other women. Since we've talked so much and so openly about my commitment to purity, her heart is at total ease. I don't get caught up in admiring the beauty of other women, and I don't talk about other women. Since I've starved my eyes of everything sensual except for her, I find her absolutely captivating, and she knows it. From Steve, Full Connection. I experienced a similar story. One of the things I brought into my marriage with Sandy was a secret compartment I'd guarded for years. Inside it was a girlfriend from much earlier in my life, the first true love I really had. I didn't fantasize about her, but I considered this secret compartment to be mine forever, a private place out of which I could draw fond old memories of what life was like with her. It wasn't until I was willing to give up that secret compartment that I was fully able to connect with Sandy. Once that happened, I no longer wanted to contact my old girlfriend because I was focused on Sandy and wanting her. Perhaps you also have secret compartments labeled old girlfriends or pornography or favorite websites. You must forsake these private secret compartments because they're harmful. Friends who trust. Your sexual purity will also mean regaining your relationship to your friends. Both Fred and I know that if a friend ever had to leave one of us alone in a hotel room with his wife for an evening, he could be fully assured that nothing dishonorable would happen. That was not always the case. Of course, that scenario will never happen, but that's not the point. We simply know that we're trustworthy now. Our friends don't have to worry about us undressing their wives in our minds or daydreaming of what it might be like to be making love to one of them. Trust is important in the body of Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 15 through 20, Paul says that not only does a sexually immoral man sin against his own body, but he also sins against the body of Christ and his friends within the body. Our friends trust us to be pure. A failure would crush their spirits as well as our own. We must be trustworthy. From Fred, Your Legacy. In your relationships with your children, the knowledge that you could break patterns of generational sin is wondrous. Consider what the psalmist wrote. "As for man, his days are like grass, but from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him, and his righteousness with their children's children." Psalm number 103, verses 15 and 17. God is obviously interested in saving you as an individual. After all, he sent his son to die for you, personally. But he's equally interested in you as a link in an important chain because God knows that a Christian legacy, when passed on, has the power to change generations for the good. Likewise, sin can affect families for generations, as it did in mine. I came from a family in which the men loved sex and pornography and ditched their wives or were caught up in affairs. Having followed in their footsteps, I can still remember the pictures I viewed in Playboy and Gallery magazines more than 20 years ago. I can also remember the many girlfriends and our moments in bed. But the Lord and I won, and the generational sin was broken. My 16-year-old son Jason is now a handsome, strapping, 6-foot adolescent with an easy smile and friendly ways. Not long ago, Jason was with friends who had some pornography. He walked away. My son walked away. You don't understand what that means to me. If you're coming out of generational sin, you must continue to fight the good fight for your children and for your children's children. A man once said to D.L. Moody, "The world has not yet seen what God can do with a man fully devoted to him." Moody responded, "I am that man." Unlike Moody, young men today are spending so much of their spiritual energy fighting off sexual fevers. What if your son were kept free from this draining fever in the first place, and all of his spiritual energy could be spent on God's call in his kingdom? It can be done. The world has not yet seen what God can do with an army of young men free from sexual fevers. If you're a father, have you worked hard enough to keep your son pure so that he might qualify for such an army? Can you yourself answer as Moody did, "I am that man"? A share in building the kingdom. After my salvation, I had a deep excitement for Christ and thought about entering full-time ministry. I looked into schools and seminaries, excited at the thought of spending my time telling everyone about Christ Jesus. Having been freed from a ruggedly promiscuous lifestyle, I found God's forgiveness to be intoxicating. But then I was brought back to earth as I read in Scripture a conversation King David had with his son Solomon. David is recounting what God had told him years earlier through the prophet Nathan regarding David's desire to build the Jewish temple. David said to Solomon, "My son, I had it in my heart to build a house for the name of the Lord my God. But this word of the Lord came to me, 'You have shed much blood and have fought many wars. You are not to build a house for my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight.'" 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 7 and 8. Because David was a man of war and had shed much blood, he was not to build the temple. That task, God told David, was reserved for his son, Solomon. "But you will have a son who will be a man of peace and rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. He is the one who will build a house for my name." 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 9 and 10. I wasn't spoken to directly by a prophet as David was, but this verse jumped off the page to me. It seemed clear that God was telling me something like this: David was a man of war and had shed much blood, so I could not have him build my temple. Similarly, you are a man of deep sexual sin. I cannot have you at this time building my kingdom full time. I want you to first learn to be a simple pillar in a local church. If you are faithful, your son will help build my kingdom full time. This was devastating to me, but I was certain I'd heard him correctly. Fortunately, David's great heart inspired me. As I meditated on these verses, I decided to joyfully do the next best thing. Since I couldn't work full-time building the kingdom, I could prepare my son Jason as best I could. I set my heart diligently, as David did with Solomon, helping Jason with Bible reading, memory work, music lessons, and church attendance. I invited missionaries to stay in our home so Jason could hear how they were impacting people's lives. Most of all, I did my best to keep him pure. I watched whom he played with, explained the dangers of pornography, and kept him from viewing sensual films and television shows. I have to be a good example because I remember how it was with Dad and me. Early in life, Dad promised me $100 upon graduation from high school if I never smoked or drank. I never did smoke or drink through high school, and on graduation day he paid up. But what happened in college? I never started smoking, but I did start drinking. Why did I start one and not the other? When I was 10 years old, I watched Dad, a 2-pack-a-day smoker, receive the news that he had 6 months to live. Doctors removed a lung, and I watched him endure pain resulting from the operation. Dad, who had failed several attempts to stop smoking, suddenly quit cold turkey. He never smoked again. While the particular lung disease he contracted wasn't directly caused by smoking, the dangers of smoking and my father's heroic effort to survive made a deep impression on me. What about alcohol? Dad told me I shouldn't drink, but when he mowed the lawn or went fishing, he always capped the day with a beer or two. From my earliest age, whenever we went to restaurants, Dad ordered a martini. The unique shape of the glass, the olive, and the whole aura, shaken but not stirred, was glamorous to my young mind. When my time of decision came with alcohol, I couldn't think of a single person who didn't drink, certainly not my dad. No example in my life spoke to not drinking, so I started. When your son questions what he should watch, what he should do with the pornography other boys show him, or what he should do when that cute girl gets him alone and starts unbuttoning her blouse, will anyone be speaking against it? It won't be his friends. Even his church buddies will tell him to go for it. Your voice had better be loud and crystal clear, because it will probably be the only one whispering, "Flee immorality, son." Your example must be the argument opposing temptation. Avoiding the carnage. I'm working diligently to prepare Jason for work in God's kingdom, knowing that for the time being, I myself won't be having any broad leadership in ministry. There were times, I must admit, that I didn't understand why this was true, but I came to a better understanding when I saw the fall of other prominent Christian leaders, when I witnessed the divorce of two key couples involved in marriage ministry at my church, and when two of my own pastors fell to adultery as well. One of them was our senior pastor, and it took our church more than a decade to fully recover. The other was an associate pastor. I saw the results of his sin close up since I was part of a recovery team to help restore him to the ministry. I remember thinking how, until that time, I'd never truly understood the word carnage. While I once chafed under God's limits for me in ministry, I don't chafe anymore. I know that as a pre-marriage teacher at my church, where I instruct 30 couples a year, any personal fall into sin would have ramifications rippling across the church. And I've known since the beginning that as I teach on purity in my church, I'd better be strong. It's time. God is waiting to bless you. Your wife needs you to step up. Your kids need you to break generational sin. Your church needs you to serve. Do you agree it's time? Good. Let's put together a battle plan. The landing craft ramps are falling open, and it's time to hit the beach. Chapter 10, Your Battle Plan. Before we started winning our own battles for purity, we had a number of false starts, partly because we hadn't really made a decision. We sort of wanted purity and sort of didn't. We didn't understand the enemy and how to approach it. The whole business of sexual integrity was mysterious. Let's say you're in the landing craft ready to attack your sexual sin. You've made your decision. You've decided to follow your leaders as you storm the beach. The landing craft ramp falls open. With a shout, you step courageously into the fray. But, unknown to you, the deceptive ocean currents have flushed a deep hole on the ocean floor right in front of the landing craft. You have no idea what's happened, but you're suddenly in water over your head, and the weight of your pack is sending you to the bottom. You're drowning. Your battle is over before you even took a second step. Satan's greatest weapon against you is just such deception. He knows Jesus has already purchased your freedom. He also knows that once you see the simplicity of this battle, you'll win in short order. So he deceives and confuses. He tricks you into thinking you're a helpless victim, someone who'll need years of group therapy. He tells you that sexual sin is just part of being a man, and there's nothing you can do about it. He tells you all about sexual addiction and makes you believe that you're not a sex addict, that you're off the hook, that you don't need an obedient life. And such deception is only one of the ways that he tries to beat you. This chapter will remove the mystery surrounding the enemy as you launch into battle. We'll define your actual objective in practical terms, and we'll describe some critical attributes of your sexual sin. Pay close attention to these details, because once you step into the fray, you want to come out of this victorious. Your objective in this war. Your goal is sexual purity. Here's a good working definition of it. Good because of its simplicity. You are sexually pure when no sexual gratification comes from anyone or anything but your wife. Purity means stopping sexual gratification that comes to us from outside our marriage. But how do we stop it? We're able to draw outside sexual gratification from only two places, the eyes and the mind. Therefore, to be successful in the battle for our sexual perimeter, we must blockade the shipping lanes of the eyes and mind. Beyond that, we also want to make sure that we have healthy, positive affections and attitudes in our relationships with our wives. In other words, we want our hearts to be right. That means your objective in the war against lust is to build three perimeters of defense into your life. One, with your eyes. Two, in your mind. Three, in your heart. Think of the first perimeter, your eyes, as your outermost defense, a wall with keep out signs around it. It defends your eyes by covenant, as Job did. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. And you do that by training your eyes to bounce from objects of lust. Your eyes must bounce from the sensual, something they aren't currently doing. We'll explain this thoroughly in part 4. With the second perimeter, your mind, you don't so much block out the objects of lust, but you evaluate and capture them. A key verse to support you here is 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 5. We take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. You must train your mind to take thoughts captive, something it doesn't currently do. You'll learn much more about this in part 5. Your third objective, which we'll investigate in part 6, is to build your innermost defense perimeter in your heart. This perimeter is built by strengthening your affections for your wife and your commitment to the promises and debts you owe her. Your marriage can die from within if you neglect your promise to love, honor, and cherish your wife. Honoring and cherishing are your key actions in establishing this defense perimeter, and this applies even if you're single. You want to honor and cherish every date, just as you hope every guy is honoring and cherishing your future wife when he goes out with her. So here's your battle plan. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. Setting up defense perimeters and choosing not to sin. You'll have freedom from sexual impurity as soon as those defense perimeters are in place. Sexually, your outer life will finally match the inner life God created in you. Because of your long struggle with sexual impurity, this attack plan may seem too simple to be effective. No matter. As you study the attributes of your enemy, you'll realize that simplicity is more than sufficient. So before we move on to how to build the three defense perimeters, let's remove the mystery surrounding sexual sin by gaining a better understanding of the enemy, that we might not be deceived. Impurity is a habit. Some may think that impurity is genetic, like the color of our eyes. I'm male, so I'll have impure eyes and an impure mind. But we can't blame our roving eyes on genetics, even though men are definitely more visually oriented than women. Some men see themselves as victims of impure eyes and thoughts, as if that excuse absolved them from all responsibility. The simple truth? Impurity is a habit. It lives like a habit. When some hot-looking babe walks in, your eyes have the bad habit of bouncing toward her, sliding up and down. When some glistening jogger runs past you, your eyes habitually run away with her. When the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue arrives in your mailbox, out of habit, you fantasize over the curves and crevices, fondling every glossy image. The fact that impurity is merely a habit comes as a surprise to many men. It's like discovering that the big bully has a glass chin and that you don't have to cower anymore. If impurity were genetic or some victimizing spell, you'd be helpless. But since impurity is a habit, it can be changed. You have hope, because if it lives like a habit, it can die like a habit. We believe it can be done in 6 weeks. This is great news, since habit breaking is familiar ground, hardly mysterious. We've all dealt with bad habits. What do you do with them? You simply replace them with new and better ones. That's it. If you can practice this new habit with great focus for a month to 6 weeks, soon the old habit will seem unnatural. Sexual impurity is not a sickness or imbalance for most men. Our eyes love the sexual, and our bad habits arise from our maleness. We have the bad habit of seeking cheap thrills from any dark corner we stumble into. We've habitually chosen the wrong way, and now we must habitually choose the right way. Don't misunderstand. We're not saying your habits have no relationship to your emotions or circumstances. Glenn told us, "My sexual sin became much worse when I was under a deadline at work, and especially when my wife and I fought or I felt unloved and unappreciated. It seemed at those times that I was compelled to sin sexually and couldn't say no. Honestly, I didn't think that would ever change simply by changing the habits of my eyes. But guess what? Once I got my eyes under control, these same deadlines and fights no longer compelled me sexually. My impurity just seemed to wither away on its own." For Glenn, job-related stress and lack of acceptance were not the root cause of his sexual impurity. The sexual impurity was simply one way he dealt with these emotions and circumstances. In short, he ran to impurity as an escape. But when he removed the sexual impurity, he began processing these things in other ways. Working like a habit. Impurity not only lives like a habit, it also works like a habit. The same is also true for purity. It works like a habit. What do we mean? Once we set a habit in concrete, we can forget about it. The habit will take care of business with little conscious thought, enabling us to focus our attention on other things. For example, we all have a habitual way of getting up in the morning. Many of us slowly climb out of bed, brush our teeth, take a shower, get dressed, and eat Wheaties with the kids at 7:10 a.m. We don't even have to think about it. We could do our morning routine in our sleep, and we usually do. While sexual impurity works like a bad habit, sexual purity works like a good habit. This should be encouraging for you. As you enter the fight against impurity, the exhausting battle might have you saying to yourself, "I can't work this hard at purity the rest of my life." But if you can just hang in there a little longer, the habit of purity will get a foothold and fight for you, requiring much less conscious effort. Currently, your impure habits claw and clutch. You sin without even thinking. For instance, your eyes bounce to any short skirt that moseys by. Without thinking, your bad habits start kicking in. But with the habit of purity in place, when a woman's dress flies up on a windy day, you'll look away automatically without even thinking. If you wanted to peek, you'd have to force your eyes to do so. From Fred, forcing a look. Hard to imagine? Then consider this little story. After training my eyes to look away, I was sunbathing with Brenda on a Florida beach. Brenda called my attention to a bikini-clad woman approaching us. "Fred, look, you won't believe this." I turned to look, but initially I couldn't. The good habits had become so strong I had to force my eyes to look. "She's way too old to wear that," Brenda said about the 60-something woman. I'm not sure what surprised me more, having to force my eyes to look at a woman in a bikini, or seeing someone that old wearing something that skimpy. Impurity fights like an addiction. Impurity of the eyes and mind lives like a habit, but fights like an addiction. Many habits are addictive. Smokers get the urge to smoke. Drug users get a Jones. Alcoholics get the shakes. For overcoming some addictions, the addictive source can be gradually reduced. For others, the best method is cold turkey. What works best with sexual impurity? Cold turkey. You cannot just taper down. We tried. It didn't work, because we found our minds and eyes were too tricky and deceitful. With tapering, whatever impurity you do allow seems to multiply in its impact and the habit won't break. Besides, tapering down also brings with it the possibility of sexual binges that might go on for days. Binges crush your spirit. I used to try to stop my sexual sin without really understanding what I was fighting, said Cliff. I might grit my teeth and do well for a while, but then suddenly, maybe because I hadn't had sex in a while, or because of some lustful thoughts that just got carried away, I would masturbate. Then I would say to myself, well, since I failed, I might as well fail big. I would masturbate 2-3 times a day for the next week or two before I could get back the strength to fight again. I can't tell you how many times I've binged like this. Cold turkey it must be. But how? By totally starving your eyes of all things sensual besides your wife. For singles, this means starving your eyes of all things sensual. This will help you overcome the desire for premarital sex with the women you date. If you starve your eyes just like the married guys, you'll see your date as a person and not an object. We'll teach you how to starve your eyes in part 4. But for now, know that you can expect an inner urge to fail. You're accustomed to satisfying a portion of your sexual hunger with your eyes anytime and anywhere you please. Your body will fight for these highs. As you advance in purity, that part of your sexual hunger once fed by your eyes remains unfed and doesn't just disappear. This demanding hunger runs to the only available pantry left to you, your wife. In the next chapter, we'll see more about how this works out to satisfy both of you. Spiritual possession and oppression. Now that we've touched on Satan's part in our battle against impurity, let's focus on whether sexual impurity represents some form of demon possession. You aren't possessed by the devil when impurity runs rampant in your life, and you don't need an exorcism. Although it sometimes feels like an evil gremlin inside you is driving you to sin, these are merely the compulsions of your bad habits and hormones. You're simply out of control and must bring them all back under the control of your regenerated spirit. While there's no spiritual possession involved, there could be an element of spiritual oppression. From Fred, a turning point. In my case, you be the judge. Near my 6-week mark of going cold turkey, I had a very sensual and violent dream. I was tempted sexually in an extremely enticing manner, and yet, for the first time in a dream, I actually said, no, I won't. You'll know you're nearing victory when even in the freedom of your dream state, your subconscious mind still chooses purity. Then came violent hand-to-hand combat, and I cried out, in the name of Jesus, I will defeat you. As I said the words, in the name of Jesus, the battle turned in my favor. But when I said the words, I will defeat you, the battle turned violently against me, since I had no power of my own. In desperation, I cried out every name of Jesus I could think of. Suddenly, I awoke, praising God out loud. It was Sunday morning. Several hours later in church, I worshiped freely all service long for the first time. Praises continued to bubble up out of my heart the rest of the day, that night, and into the next day. For someone who had felt such distance from God for so long, the feeling was glorious. The explanation? I'm convinced a spiritual oppression in my life was crushed that night, though I can't be dogmatic. I've never been one to look for Satan behind every rock. All I know is that before that night, I'd never been able to worship freely. After that night, it flowed easily, and it continues to this day. Purity always brings spiritual opposition. While there may not be spiritual oppression involved in your battle, there will always be spiritual opposition. The enemy is constantly near your ear. He doesn't want you to win this fight, and he knows the lies that so often break men's confidence and their will to win. Expect to hear lies and plenty of them. What we've told you is the truth. There is peace and tranquility for you on the other side of this war. There is immeasurable spiritual gain. The deceiver will tell you that Steve Arterburn and Fred Stoker are crazy, and that you'll soon be as crazy as both of them combined if you follow their ideas. To help you recognize Satan's lies when you hear them, here's a list of some of them. After each lie, we'll state the actual truth. Satan: you're the only one dealing with this problem. If anyone ever finds out, you'll be the laughingstock of the church. The truth: most men deal with this problem, so no one will laugh. Satan: you failed again. You'll never be able to train your eyes. It's impossible. The truth: it isn't impossible. Job trained his eyes, didn't he? He was a man just like you. Satan: you're being so legalistic. The law is dead and only brings death. The truth: God still has standards of behavior for us, and you're responsible to live purely by His standards. Satan: oh, come on, don't be such a moron. This habit-changing plan will never work. The truth: the plan will work. Because for most men, the problem of sexual impurity is nothing more than bad choices evolving into bad habits. Satan: why fight this costly battle when the costs of your impurity are so minimal? The truth: you can't always see them, but the costs of your sin are greater than you think. Satan: why live in this high state of alert for the rest of your life? Give up now and I'll leave you alone. The truth: Satan just might keep his word and leave you alone, but even if he did, the laws of reaping and sowing would still exact their payment from you. You cannot avoid the costs of sexual impurity. You might as well fight. Satan: you'll be awkward in business situations now, especially with women. You won't fit in and you'll lose business. The truth: no, you won't be awkward in business situations. You'll be more at ease than ever. Masturbation: a symptom, not the root. If your sexual impurity includes masturbation, as it does for many men, then some further deceptive tactics from the enemy that you may encounter would include the argument that masturbation is the root of your problem, or that it's caused by some psychological pain from your past. Let's tackle those issues head on. Let us say it clearly. Masturbation is a symptom of uncontrolled eyes and free-racing thoughts. When you create the new habits of bouncing your eyes and taking thoughts captive, masturbation will cease. Until then, it won't. There's no sense in targeting masturbation itself because you won't be attacking the real source of the problem. Target the eyes and mind instead. Listen to Ed Cole, a pastor with a national speaking platform. Not only does pornography encourage its readers to create an image in their mind, but it also entices them to fantasize about it. Usually these fantasies involve an erotic act that can only be satisfied with someone else or by masturbation. Once an image is created in the mind, that picture actually becomes an idol. The habit of masturbation becomes an act of worshiping that idol. Eventually, it creates a stronghold in the mind and becomes a trap. Some people think I'm old-fashioned for preaching this, but I continually encounter men who have lost all sense of balance because of habitual masturbation. One man asked, "How many times a day would you consider habitual?" That's reason enough to teach it. Scripture is silent on the topic of masturbation. Some might even make a case that isolated instances of masturbation to relieve sexual tension are okay, if you're focused on your wife, not some supermodel, during periods of separation or illness. Wanton masturbation tied to pornography or whatever gets your motor running is always sin, putting distance between you and God. If you desire holiness, you must stop masturbating. Becoming sexually charged from images other than your wife isn't right. If you want freedom from masturbation, you must put the axe to the roots. What are the roots? They're your stopping short of God's standard, accepting through your eyes and your mind more than a hint of immorality in your life. Masturbation and psychological pain. Masturbation is not caused by psychological pain. Some men will argue this point, claiming their masturbation habit isn't rooted in lust, but in something entirely less crass. Often that something is a constellation of hurt, rejection, and loss of love in their lives caused by childhood trauma or inept parenting from years past. Do these hurts cause masturbation? Let's take a little true-false test. Which of the following statements are true? 1. Men must first deal with the hurt before they can be free from masturbation. 2. Since rejection causes masturbation, rejection and masturbation must always coexist together. And 3. Masturbation can exist in a man even though he has no impurity of the eyes and mind. None of these three statements is true. Here's the reality of the situation. It isn't true that you must deal with the hurt first. You can be free from masturbation without ever dealing with the hurt. 2. Rejection and masturbation can each exist in a person's life without the other. 3. Masturbation needs the foreplay of the impure eyes and mind to exist. But, you ask, why do masturbation and psychological pain exist together so often? Because of rejection and lost love, men begin to seek for this lost love in all the wrong places. In their search, where's the path of least resistance? A pretend lover, a pornographic lover with a permanent smile, a lover who never says no, one who never rejects, one who never abandons and is always discreet, one who supports the man's ego in the midst of his self-doubt, one who forever says everything will be okay no matter how high the pressure goes. This path is a chosen path, a path made available by the impure eyes stoking the sexual fever, providing an unending pool of lovers from which to draw. The reason rejection and masturbation coexist so often is because of our maleness and our easy ability to draw true sexual gratification through our eyes. The male eyes give us the means to sin broadly and at will. Then, because men get their intimacy from the acts just prior to and during intercourse, masturbation brings a real sense of intimacy and acceptance. This intimacy salves the hurt and rejection. This intimacy is attained easily and without risk, far more easily than at some bar or whorehouse. In fact, it's attained more easily than with a wife who might say no when you need intimacy most. That's why men choose to masturbate so often. What if the means to sin are taken away by training the eyes? Masturbation is no longer the path of least resistance. He'll look elsewhere for love. Hopefully, he'll finally deal with the rejection itself. But the masturbation? It goes away, and the hurt manifests itself in some other way. Men aren't victims of masturbation simply because they were victims of emotional trauma. They've chosen it. Don't be deceived. You can be free from masturbation regardless of past pain. Accountability and your wife. As we end this chapter and prepare to focus in part 4 on the first of our 3 defense perimeters, let's look at a couple of special issues. The first is accountability. For many men who are willing to fight for sexual purity, an important step is finding accountability support in a men's Bible study group, in a smaller group of 1 or 2 other men serving as accountability partners, or by going into counseling. For an accountability partner, enlist a male friend, perhaps someone older and well-respected in the church, to encourage you in the heat of battle. The men's ministry at your church can also help you find someone who can pray for you and ask you the tough questions. Here's how it might go. Let's say Nathan asks for an accountability partner. Ron, a longtime Christian with experience in this area, is asked to help out Nathan. Ron calls Nathan up to chat. Ron asks, "How's it going, Nathan?" Both of them know that this refers to masturbation. Nathan answers, "I plead the 5th. "Uh-oh, talk to me. It's been happening every other day for the past 2 weeks. "Are you reading the Bible?" Ron asks. "Yes." "Are you praying?" "Yes." "What's the problem, then?" "Too much TV," Nathan answers. "HBO and Baywatch reruns." Following this conversation, Ron begins contacting Nathan every day because the problem has accelerated and requires more contact. Sometimes Nathan needs to be encouraged. Sometimes he needs to be challenged to do what's right. In the end, though, it comes down to whether Nathan has made a decision to win, a decision for purity. Accountability works only when coupled with a firm commitment to win. Let us caution you, however, from enlisting your wife as your accountability partner. There's no way most guys will get real with their spouses in something as starkly personal as one's thought life and masturbation habits. From Fred, telling your wife. That brings up the issue of how much your wife should know about your battle. As your understanding of sexual purity grows, victory will seem possible. With hope rising, perhaps you'll want to tell your wife about your struggle with impurity, so that she, your dear, gracious wife, may help you win. But don't be in a big hurry. Remember, our habits have rooted in our maleness. We understand them. Women don't. Almost without fail, women who hear about your sexual impurity will think of you as a pervert. Brenda and I were once discussing the fall of a prominent TV preacher to adultery. If he were my husband, she stated, I could not stand to even be around him. He would make me sick. Whoa. Brenda doesn't mince words, does she? But the plot quickly turned the next day when she broached the topic again. She told me she was feeling sorry for the disgraced preacher because he'd been desperately struggling alone against a secret sin. Brenda felt that if only his wife had known, she could have helped him through prayer. Fred, she said, if you had such a problem, wouldn't you come to me and tell me? I would want to be praying for you and helping you. I burst out laughing. I couldn't tell you anything like that, I said. Just yesterday you said you were totally repulsed by it. I'd feel like you wanted me to be cast into a leper colony if you knew about such a thing. I know some men will disagree with me on this point, and that's fine, because you know your wife better than I do. But most wives react with shock and revulsion rather than with mercy and prayer. Besides, how would she respond to you if she knew you had quit the battle, as you'll be tempted to do, especially in the first few weeks? Before telling her, you had better check your will to win during the heat of battle. If it will take a while before you really, really want to win, you'd be better off waiting to tell her, because she'll be watching. Brenda recently told me that even now, all these years later, she occasionally watches my eyes when we go past billboards just to check on me. With the good habits in place, I haven't failed her, but who needs that pressure if you aren't ready for it? Once you're absolutely sure that you hate your sin and are ready to change, tell your wife. By this time, she'll suspect something anyway, since your entire sex drive will now be leveled at her. Having gone through this battle, I know that there are some practical ways a wife can help. First, your wife can be a methadone-like fix when your temperature is rising. Second, when searching for a new sexual equilibrium with her, it obviously helps if she knows what's going on. Third, once your wife understands your eyes, she won't ask you to watch a women's beach volleyball game with her while you're going cold turkey. Release for singles. As a final point, let's explore how the battle plan works in particular for singles. One reason singles can get tripped up in their quest for purity is that they feel overmatched. That's why they're quick to say, it's easy for you to talk about sexual purity, you're married. Earlier, we dismissed marriage as an adequate answer to purity problems, but the question for singles remains. What are you going to do with the sexual pressure you sometimes feel? First of all, you have to take by faith that once you get your eyes and mind under control, the sexual pressure will drop off dramatically. You bring most of the sexual pressure onto yourself through visual, sensual stimulation and mental fantasy. Even so, there remains the male 72-hour cycle of sperm production. Without the impurity of the eyes, the pressure generated by lust is gone, but there's still a natural physical pressure for release, though much weaker. What am I going to do about that, you might ask? How will I get release? God has supplied the way of release, something with which you're familiar. Clinically, it's called nocturnal emissions, but somewhere in a dank, smelly football locker room, some kid decided to call it a wet dream, and that name stuck. The good news for singles is that nocturnal emissions can work for you in your quest for purity. They also can work for married guys who aren't as sexually active as they would like to be. You may wonder how such dreams will work toward purity. After all, some of these dreams are pretty hot and heavy. But those hot and heavy aspects arise from what you're putting into your mind each day. The same pure eyes and mind that keep you from actively seeking release during the day will limit the impurity that your mind can use in dreams at night. Even these dreams will be dramatically purer in scope and content. Your goal from here. Now that you've made your decision for sexual purity, you can see more than ever why failing to eliminate every hint of sexual immorality from your life is dangerous. The visual sensuality of immodest dress, movies, commercials, and all the rest will feed your eyes and ignite you sexually. The addictive nature of the chemical responses in your brain's pleasure centers spin tight cords of bondage. To break these cords, you must cut off the sensual images through your eyes and mind. That's your goal, and the rest of the book is dedicated to showing you how to do it. Level your sights on the enemy, brother. It's time. The Heart of a Woman. Once your husband engages in the battle for sexual integrity, here are some things you can pray for him. 1. Pray that God would keep him from wavering and stumbling. Ask God to put more light on his path and more courage in his step. 2. Pray against spiritual opposition in the form of lies. As you know, Satan will lie to him to weaken his will to win. Pray that Satan's efforts to confuse him will be ineffective. And 3. Pray against possible spiritual oppression. Ask God to release power to break any spiritual oppression over your lives and your home that has resulted from his sexual sin. Along with prayer, there are other ways you can help him win this battle. Once he tells you he's going cold turkey, be like a merciful vial of methadone for him. Increase your availability to him sexually, though this may be difficult for you since your husband might have told you some things that repulse you. Since your sex drive as a woman is tied to relationship, you may feel betrayed, just as if your husband had had an actual affair. It may help you to view this from a male's perspective, where relationship and sex do not have such a tight bond. Please don't misunderstand us. His lusting was definitely a moral betrayal, but it wasn't necessarily a betrayal of the heart. You may still be his one and only true love, the one that he could never, ever leave. He has a fractional addiction to the chemical high, but don't assume his heart for you is untrue. Mercy is probably your best tack, with accountability, of course. On another issue, do you believe that God has given you, as a wife, a responsibility to be a role model of godliness and holiness to your husband? We received some interesting comments to this question. Some women don't feel modeling godliness for their husband is their role at all. Kathy said, "My responsibility is to love him, and that will manifest itself in godliness. But I feel the role model responsibility is primarily his, since he's the leader of our home." We don't disagree with Kathy's last statement, but we want to point out that since you're one flesh with your husband, you have a right, even a duty, to play such a role as well. If a wife acts as a role model, how should it look in everyday life? Heather said, "My first responsibility as a role model is to be pure and true sexually to my husband, as I expect him to be." Wendy said, "I don't try to get Mark to do things that we both know are wrong, like watching sensual movies," she said. "I don't do things that would be a stumbling block to him, like leaving Victoria's Secret catalogs lying around open." Many women feel that they care more about godliness than their husbands do. As men, this is to our shame. Andrea said, "Lately, through the preaching of several men and a worship conference a year ago, I met God in a new way and have changed more in the past year than ever before. God has given me a deep desire to purify my life and my home. It's been frustrating at times, though, because there have been many things I've wanted to change, but I've met resistance from my husband. He's a wonderful Christian, but in talking with my sister recently, we've concluded there's a tendency among men to brush off women's attempt to purify our homes. For example, I'm no longer comfortable with certain movies. I don't like to watch them, nor do I like my children to watch them. But rather than come across as a holier-than-thou person, God has helped me keep my mouth shut after voicing my concerns, and instead pray about the situation and to pray for my husband. Kathy added, I've never felt I cared more about holiness than my husband, but I think I put more energy into it. Maybe it comes more easily to a woman, I don't know. If he seems to be struggling in a certain area, if I confront him or try to be a leader, it has much less effect than when I pray and fast for him. Part 4. Victory with Your Eyes. Chapter 11. Bouncing the Eyes. To set up your first defense perimeter with your eyes, you want to employ the strategies of bouncing your eyes and starving your eyes, as well as the tactics of taking up a sword and a shield. Let's first consider bouncing. You can win this battle by training your eyes to bounce away from the sights of pretty women and sensual images. If you bounce your eyes for 6 weeks, you can win this war. The problem is that your eyes have always bounced toward the sexual, and you've made no attempt to end this habit. To combat it, you need to build a reflex action by training your eyes to immediately bounce away from the sexual, like the jerk of your hand away from a hot stove. Let's repeat that for emphasis. When you bounce your eyes toward a woman, you must bounce away immediately. But why must the bounce be immediate? After all, you might argue, a glance isn't the same as lusting. If we define lusting as staring open-mouthed until drool pools at your feet, then a glance isn't the same as lusting. But if we define lusting as any look that creates a little chemical high, that little pop, then we have something a bit more difficult to measure. This chemical high happens more quickly than you realize. In our experience, drawing the line at immediate is clean and easy for the mind and eyes to understand. This line in the sand seems to work effectively. So how do we train this new bouncing reflex? For openers, the habit of what your eyes look at is no different than any other habit. Since experts say that anything done consistently for 21 days becomes a new habit, you must find some way to consistently bounce your eyes over time. Your tactics. When you start bouncing your eyes, your body will fight against you in peculiar, unexpected ways. Sexual sin has an addictive nature, and your body will not want to give up on its pleasures. You'll have to creatively respond in your quest for purity, and you do that through these two logical steps. 1. Study yourself. How and where are you attacked most? And 2. Define your defense for each of the greatest enemies you've identified. Your first step is listing your own greatest enemies. What are the most obvious and prolific sources of sensual images apart from your wife? Where do you look most often? Where are you weakest? From Fred, My Greatest Enemies. I had no problem coming up with a list of my 6 biggest areas of weakness. 1. Lingerie advertisements. 2. Female joggers in tight nylon shorts. 3. Billboards showing scantily clad women. 4. Beer and bikini commercials. 5. Movies rated PG-13 or higher. 6. Receptionists with low-cut or tight blouses. What are your main areas of weakness? In choosing them, remember that they must be areas from which you visually draw sexual satisfaction. Some make the mistake of choosing non-visual weaknesses for this list. For instance, Justin initially included the following 3 on his list. 1. Showers. 2. Being home alone. 3. Working late. We can all understand why these are troublesome. In the shower, you're nude with warm water cascading down your body. When you're home alone, no one is around to discover you. When working late, you feel sorry for yourself and need comfort. But such weak spots needn't be targeted if you train your eyes to bounce and eliminate the visual stimuli. With no food for the metal fantasies, the sexual fever that draws your mind to sin in these situations will be broken. These situations will lose their power naturally. Defining your defenses. I can't define the best defense for your weaknesses, but let me share mine so you'll get a feel for the process. Lingerie ads. Lingerie advertisements were my worst enemy and remained difficult to control for quite some time. I was successfully bouncing my eyes in every other area long before I had total victory here. Why? Those ad inserts were the most sexually satisfying images of them all, and from time to time, I hit the motherlode, a swimsuit feature or an exercise feature illustrated with bun-fitting spandex all around. Not only did I train my eyes to bounce away from such print ads, I also trained myself not to pick them up in the first place. My defense was to establish a number of rules to keep these images out of my hands before my eyes had a chance to see them. Rule 1. When my hand reached for a magazine or insert, if I sensed in the slightest way that my underlying motive was to see something sensual, I forfeited my right to pick up that magazine or insert, forever. To be honest, this didn't work well at first. Even though sensing my motive was easy, forfeiting my right to pick it up was not. My flesh simply ignored my spirit, shouting, "Shut up, I want this and I'll have it." My flesh won time after time. But as I began to succeed in the other 5 areas, my hatred for the sin grew. And as it grew, my will and discipline grew stronger. I never gave up, and the lingerie ads finally failed to ensnare me. Rule 2. If a magazine had an overtly sensual female on the cover, I tore off the cover and threw it away. Mail-order clothing catalogs or swimsuit magazines with sensual cover pictures can sit on your coffee table, drawing your eyes all month long. Now I ask you this. What if a full-breasted woman in a teensy-weensy-teensy bikini came to your home and sat down on your coffee table and said, "I'll just sit here for a while, but I promise to leave by the end of the month"? Would you let her stay to catch your eye every time you walked in the room? I don't think so. So why do you leave her there in picture form? Once, I remember Brenda asking, "What's been happening to all our magazine covers?" But that's how I handled the problem. And today, she happily grants me full censorship rights. Rule 3. If I was genuinely looking for sale prices on camping equipment or tools in department store inserts, I would allow myself to pick up the insert, but I forced myself to start looking from the back. Don't ask me how I know, but the lingerie ads are usually found on pages 2 and 3. The camping, automotive, and tool ads are on the last pages. By opening the insert from the rear, I avoided seeing the young model's entire